Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. Today we're going to do pages 222 to 239, a little bit shorter than we have been, as session number 9 of our review of The Camp of the Saints by Jean Raspail, written in a vision back in 1972. The earlier 8 and the 3 to come will all be found at alexlinder.com and vnnforum.com. Let's dig in. Chapter 40, page 222. At the selfsame hour, 147 minutes ahead of the refugees' actual landing, the myth of redemption by the Ganges Armada swept the nation's industrial zones in plant after plant. Once again, we should point out that this coincidental occurrence was in no way due to any preconceived scheme on the part of the principals or to any concerted action by the usual phalanx of outside agitators. If the third world factory workers of France rose up in a spontaneous revolt that night, in places as far removed from one another as Paris, Lille, Lyon, and Mulhouse, it's because for the last 3 days the pent-up tension had built up to such a pitch that the lid finally blew in a seething eruption of wild, expectant hopes. In ordinary times, no one would have dared to take such risks. Every man was intent on keeping his job and his hard-earned pay. The unions, of course, worked hard to recruit the swarthy rabble and would throw them into the fray from time to time. As the rules of the social war game demanded, though really with an eye to improving the French workers' profits perched up at the top of the salary scale. The best proof was the fact that at places like Rodeo Chemical, for example, and a few other highly politicized plants, where the great emancipation revels had already begun on the day before Easter, the third world workers had resisted temptation, sticking grimly by their machines like a stray dog still clinging to a bone gnawed white. But that didn't stop them from thinking. Perhaps they weren't willing for others to share in their fabled redemption, that symbol of a million refugees landing in France to signal their deliverance. They had lived their exile alone, despite the occasional hand of friendship held out over the flood of false promises, and alone they would be resurrected. When the factory loudspeakers had broadcast the final words of the president's message, the unions lost all control. The political cells exploded, and even Caddy One Eye, C-A-D-I, in Paris, knew that now he could never keep his people in check, any more than he'll hold back his wife, Elise, speeding to the studios of Radio East, a razor hidden inside her stocking. To be honest, we have to admit, however, that the crimes committed that night, for the most part, had no needless cruelty or malice about them, no excess of subtle finesse, but seemed part of the natural order of things. One might have feared that this was to be the first wave of a fierce, brewing storm. Instead, it was the one last visible tremor in an underground upheaval. And it quickly subsided, since the country had drowned in its waters long since. Besides, one thing is sure. Even if Western-style law had survived, with its weighty decisions about justice as we know it, the courts would have judged each one of these crimes as quite defensible on social grounds, going through the motion, for appearance's sake, and handing down suspended sentences or light ones at most. The first such crime was a model of the genre. It was staged in Bicêtre, in the slaughter room of a pork-packing plant, charcuterie's Olo by name. The three Africans who worked there, stunner, hoister, and slaughterer, respectively, could go through an average of 190 pigs an hour, in two or three cut-and-dried moves, each one repeated 190 times. A grisly and gory job, and one that the regular help would have no part of. Several hundred workers depended on these three men, the ones on the sausage line, the stuffers, stringers, sorters, the ones on the tin pâté line, packers and sealers, not to mention the various supervisory personnel, the wholesalers, the retailers, as well as an assortment of executives and stockholders. Let one of these three indispensable killers suddenly have to take himself a pee, and the whole production would slow to a crawl. Such breaks, therefore, were quickly forbidden, in return for which the three were rewarded with a few extra francs per day, what the front office jokingly referred to as bladder compensation. Now, it happened that, Just that night, the management, sensing the troubles to come and the shortages sure to follow in their wake, came to the conclusion that food would be trumps, and that the industry stood to make a killing if only huge stockpiles could be laid away in time. And so the order went out through the plant to step everything up. It reached the slaughter room moments after the end of the president's speech, on the lips of the assistant production manager himself, with the promise that the bladder bonus would be doubled. "Sure enough, boss," one red-splattered black assured him, "we can sure enough do one more at least." The white man felt no more pain than any of the other pigs in the line. Stunned, hoisted, slaughtered, and hanging from his hook, between two blood-drenched hogs, he started into production. As he moved along through each successive phase, growing less and less like man and more like pork, he caused a certain amount of interest, but no special disgust. They had seen such things before, after all. At the market, in the Congo, except, that is, for a few dead white women, who promptly took to their heels or swooned dead away. As for the foremen, they just turned and ran. They had read the blank looks on the faces of their slaves and had gotten the message. The third world workers went on with their jobs, conscientious as could be, even under the final labeling of the tins where the white man's remains ended up as pâté. Perhaps we even ate at some of him ourselves. As time went by and conditions grew worse, we tended to be a good deal less fussy. Worth noting in passing was a certain worker priest, sausage stringer by trade, who said a little prayer as he tied his last knot and then murmured, "Forgive them, Lord, for they know not what they do." At which point the production line stopped. Since all the police headquarters that night were deluged with complaints of much of the same kind, which they found rather hard to believe, and since the commissioner, left to shift for himself with a pack of demoralized men, had decided to wait until morning to look into the matter, the officials of the plant were quick to agree that the whole affair must have been an accident. An explanation, in fact, that they likely put forth themselves. "Well now," the manager ventured after a minute of silence, "shall we all get back to work?" "Sure enough, boss," replied the trio of killers, turned labor leaders all of a sudden. "Like 90 pigs an hour, man, right? So France'll just eat less. Tough shit." And they added, with their calmest and pleasantest of smiles, "Of course, man, from now on we get half the take." 5 minutes later, having emptied out his safe and handed a few envelopes to his faithful watchdogs, the manager snatched his family on the run and made a dash southward for Switzerland, only to be swallowed in the great glut of cars and the shortage of gas. Once again, if the reader wants a few more details, just for the record, we might mention that the gentleman was spotted for the last time on foot, not far from Saint-Favier, of all places, where the Arabs, not content to have this town swimming pool to themselves, had co-opted their way into the town council as members of the dominant minority and had finally taken it over. The poor man would never be heard from again, all of which explains how Charcuterie's Olo, a Bicêtre, finally came to be run by the workers. In the hellish hubbub of the Quai de Javel in Paris, where third-world labor amounted to better than 80%, the revolt took on a liturgical form, like a mass or ritual sacrifice. When you take into account the fact that the profit potential of the automobile industry relies on assembly lines strictly timed and paced, it's no surprise that poor, uprooted, illiterate folk, subject to all the concentration camp fancies of a wildly disparate, retribalized existence, should have endowed the timers, those high priests of the clock almighty, with all the coercive and sacred powers of a religion forcibly imposed by the masters. Their resistance to this new faith depended on a kind of secret intrigue, replete with a whole spate of catacomb rites. If they wanted to catch their breath on the line, or settle their nerves, or just stop for a moment and muse on their distant palm grove or the big muddy river running its course between grasslands and dunes, they would rush through the prescribed moves, though, and then loll over the conclusion as if they hadn't finished, daydreaming without letting on, hand resting on the tool in question, pretending to work. And during those precious moments, they would cast quick glances among themselves, fraternal glances that bespoke the same loathing of the clocker's steady pace, as much a rejection of the new religion as a need to rest. But the clockers were always watching. No room, after all, for two colts at once, and they would speed up the rhythm or divide the jobs to make them simpler and quicker. When you're manufacturing cars, it's no good to dream of exotic palm groves or kneeling down nightly in prayer or facing Mecca. And so, when the redemptive myth of the Ganges burst onto the scene, it was toward those million messiahs that all hope secretly turned. This became quite clear at about the time of the Sao Tome affair, when the Armada had reached the height of fashion and the famous slogan, "We're all from the Ganges now," was dished up for every political and philosophical cause. Huge demonstration, but rather short-lived. Some 80,000 workers, massed by their motionless assembly lines, shouting two slogans that seemed, on the face of it, wholly unrelated. "Get the clockers off our backs!" and "We're all from the Ganges now." Then things calmed down and returned to normal, though the unions, surprised by the spontaneous uprising, had tried to keep the movement going so that they could take it over. Failing that, they settled for adopting the strange Manichaean battle cry that pitted Ganges refugees and clockers against each other as symbols of the eternal struggle between good and evil. The cry that they shouted through this plant and that, just to show that they were still a force to be reckoned with, in spite of the social tranquility decreed by the beast to lull world opinion to sleep. The clockers, at least, were given a bonus for the risks they faced. And days went by, until that night, when one of the time gobblers, chosen among the most ruthless of the lot, was trussed up like a sausage and laid on a piece of sheet metal en route to the body assembly with a sign in Arabic around his neck, "For now the 1,000 years are ended." When the massive drop hammer fell against the metal to stamp it into shape, the clocker was nothing but a puddle of blood, quickly dried in the heat. A great roar went up, and the assembly line stopped as thousands of Arabs, next to their machines, fell prostrate toward Mecca, gave thanks to Allah. The underdogs had had their scapegoat, and that was that. There were no other crimes in Javel that night. They needed only one, and everyone understood it. If we want to pursue the historical facts a bit further, here too, again, just for the record, we might point out that cars are still coming off the lines at the Javel plant, though they're awfully expensive and terribly scarce. They're reserved, first choice, for the officials of the new regime. To buy one himself, a worker in one of those people-run plants would have to pay 10 times what he makes in a year, a pleasure he can ill afford. He can take consolation, however, in using our public conveyances, chaotic and decrepit, or in joining the rest of the ill-shod pedestrians thronging the streets. When the author of these lines returned to Paris after a lengthy stay in Switzerland, his car was surrounded by breathless little urchins as if it were some new kind of toy. Of course, when they saw the Swiss plate, they all jeered and sneered. There's no changing that. But we mustn't digress. In other industrial towns, Billancourt, Vénissieux, Le Mans, and the like, the rhythm of Western life floundered and drowned in quite the same way. The fact that it owed its existence to third-world sweat doesn't change the picture. One can even claim, at the risk of prison or social extinction, that under the Western regime, the Third World did work efficiently, at least. It would have been best to take pride in the fact and establish a just master-servant relationship, instead of groaning with shame at the height of our prosperity. But why complain now? It wouldn't have made much difference, not really. With millions of us and billions of them, we couldn't have held out much longer. Now we're swept up in the Third World tide, and it's clear that their instinctual drives have won out, hands down. Everything has changed. The way people talk, the way they behave, the rhythm and rhythms of life. The play of emotions, the level of production, a whole new outlook. Even their way of not giving a damn. Then, too, with sexual appetites given free rein, it seems that the white has become the Third World, though the Third World hasn't turned white in the bargain. Clearly, they've won. For every old Ahmed who moans in private that things were better under the French, though he hardly remembers if he's talking about his native Algeria or his adopted France, how many millions scrape by on their share of the monstrous welfare budget, telling themselves that the wheel has turned, and that equality, at last, is no empty word? Such, more or less, was the prophetic vision, unintentional, no doubt, of a young West Indian girl that night at her job in a Crossey electronics plant, exclaiming simply as she plunged a screwdriver into her supervisor's breast, "Plantation days are over." A remark with a lot of history behind it. Occupied, too, that night was the hallowed pavement of the Boulevard Saint-Germain, but this time for good. To comprehend fully the scope of the event, we have to go back a few years to that scene of racial crisis, that fashioda of black against white, the Café Odeon. Faced with the example of urban America, fallen little by little into total decay, certain observers had seen the confrontation as a sign of the inevitable, though they took care not to say so in print. That wasn't the kind of thing one wrote those days, nor will it ever be again. The pure of conscience, on the other hand, roared out a mighty chorus, endless variations in every key on the famous theme, no dogs, no niggers. Hyperbole, to be sure. That wasn't it at all. What the owner of the Café Odeon had said at the time was this, quote, "I've been running the Café Odeon for almost a year and a half. It's kind of a bar and ice cream parlor combined. Most of my trade are Africans and West Indians. Anyway, on December 27th, while I'm out of town, two tough guys go over to this other table and crush out their cigarettes. Right on the table, I mean. So the help kicks them out. The next day, a lady complains that some character is trying to give her a hard time. One of the waiters, name doesn't matter, goes over and tries to straighten him out. He gets roughed up so bad he winds up in the hospital. When I get back a week later, I put my foot down. Don't serve any troublemakers, I tell them. Well, that's when they start giving me the business. Frankly, I can't take it anymore. It's a losing game. I'd rather close up." And he added, without thinking, leaving himself open to the usual epithets and insults, "How do you like that? Calling me a racist. Me, a Jew, who fought the Nazis tooth and nail." It was easy enough to understand what had happened. The blacks had decided to take over the Café Odeon and had proceeded to make life miserable for the whites who frequented it. Now, it's a known fact that racism comes in two forms. That practiced by whites, heinous and inexcusable, whatever its motives, and that practiced by blacks, quite justified, whatever its excesses, since it's merely the expression of a righteous revenge and it's up to the whites to be patient and understanding. There was even that time in Paris when an American black power leader came to the Cité Universitaire to speak at a student rally and began his speech by shouting, "Now listen, I see we got some black brothers and sisters standing and some white folks sitting. Come on, white folks, let's give up those seats." And the most amazing part of it was that the ones he was talking to got up, meek as lambs, while the others applauded. At the Café Odeon, things hadn't gone that far. The whites had held tight. They weren't there to make trouble, just to sit and drink their coffee in peace. Still, their very presence rankled and struck the blacks as a calculated slap. Hence a string of those nasty harassments that the Paris of the day found it tasteful to condone at the risk of public censure. The whites, as a result, began to keep their distance. And the owner, seeing his business about to fall apart, thanks to a wholly one-sided clientele, took steps to shore it up by refusing to serve certain, quote-unquote, blacks, and not any, quote-unquote, black, as the papers of the time so shamelessly reported. Poor man. From that point on, every black student in Paris took turns in his café, spitting on the floor, breaking glasses, glowering at the help, crushing out cigarette butts on the walls, and the like. He closed up 2 days later, and his flight was hailed as a noble victory for the universal conscience. The battleground, however, spread to the neighboring establishments, whose owners, much more clever, hung on in different ways with endless rap sessions and much licking of the boots, trying to keep their investments from sinking. The Café Odeon had been sold for half what it was worth, and the value of the building whose ground floor it occupied was already taking a dramatic plunge. That was the way matters stood, more or less, until that Easter Sunday night and Monday morning. The President of the Republic had no sooner finished speaking than the streets of the quarter, empty all night in anticipation of his address, suddenly came alive. 20,000 blacks, students mainly and a smattering of young diplomats, streamed over the hallowed pavement. Alsace-Lorraine had been retaken, and this time they would never let it go. They came from every corner, from the West Indian bars, their African dance halls, their rooms at the Cité Universitaire, wherever they had been holed up, waiting, expecting the impossible and hoping for the inevitable. At the Café Odeon, one of them stood up behind the counter and declared, "Around for everybody, on the house." The example was followed in the neighboring bars, but only in one did it threaten to cause trouble. The owner, not a man to be trifled with, grabbed his ever-ready pistol from the till and brandished it at the crowd, submerging his bar like a great spring tide. At which point, a hulking brute from Guadeloupe, head of some student activist group or other, went swaggering up, hands by his sides, and struck his chest squarely in front of the barrel. He apparently had a first-rate memory and a talent for imitation because, standing there eye to eye with the owner, he proceeded, quite simply, to recite, and it was as if the president himself were speaking. And so I'm asking every soldier and officer, every member of our police, asking them from the depths of my conscience and my soul to weigh this monstrous mission for themselves and to feel free either to accept or reject it. To kill is hard, even harder to know why. Myself, I think I know, but I don't have my finger on the trigger, and my gun isn't aimed point blank at some poor soul's flesh. My friends, whatever happens, may God help us or forgive us. That's a repeat of what the president said. Having said his say, he burst out laughing to his friends' applause. It was a curious moment as hatred gave way to a subtler emotion, as if they were sorry to see the balance shift and to lose that antagonism long advantageous to blacks of their position. Rising above the uproar, a voice called out, "Come on, boss, have one on us. And tomorrow, if you're a good boy, maybe we'll even pay for our drinks. Cheer up, we've all got to live, don't we?" "Not at this price," the owner muttered, shrugging his shoulders. Throwing down his gun, he pocketed the contents of the till. Then he walked out into the night, straight ahead, without looking back, as the crowd stepped aside and let him pass. A moment later on the boulevard, he found himself forced into a doorway as a solid mass of flesh came surging over the sidewalk, refusing to give an inch. The drudges of the depths had begun to swarm through Paris. At this point, a little-known event took place, one that historians, in their wisdom, prefer to pass over, since many a feather would doubtless be ruffled in today's high government circles were it to be discussed. We speak of the frenzied flight of all the coat and tie blacks before the army of the African swill men, sweepers, troglodytes, and menials. They were led by their witch doctors, needless to say. Especially the chief, that hero of the dismal cellar, and the ragtag priest, apostle to the slums, latter-day Cardinal Lavigerie himself, evangelist to the Africans and do-gooder of note. Ever since some of their number had begun sweeping gutters in those wee small hours when their gentlemen brethren would pile into their cars, parked all day on the hallowed pavement, the myth of a black utopia had spread through their cellars and under the sheet metal roofs of their hovels. The tribal princes were the worst offenders. What on earth did they have in common with the poor nigger pushing his broom? Skin color? Come now. How maddening it was for these upper-crust blacks, here in the heart of the capital, scene of their social successes, to find themselves on every sidewalk, by every sewer, behind every rubbish truck, face to face with their ragged doubles, cold and hungry, whose dark skin, peddled so cheaply, offended that black pride of theirs that they valued so much. We should pity them, really. That night they were caught in the midst of a truly unbearable web of hate. Abhorrence for the whites, disgust and contempt for their gutter-dwelling brothers, and above all, that loathing for the working-class black who had tracked them all the way to France as they managed to escape the fate of the race in the white man's wake. Yes, the redemptive myth of the Ganges opened many a subtle rift. Nothing seemed clear anymore in those murky waters of impending doom, waters that the beast had blackened by design, like an octopus spewing its ink. Could that be one explanation? Be that as it may, as soon as the shabby, swarthy troops came trampling the pavement in from the in front of the Café Odeon and other centers of the Black Utopia, the battalions of mannequins took to their heels like a pack of scared rabbits. Still, we have to admire their presence of mind. By daybreak, they had pulled off an amazing coup and saved their skins. Quite simply, they had made the rounds of the neighborhood, a good one, as everyone knows, ringing all the bells and saying something like this to each terrified bourgeois couple at the door. "Monsieur, madame, we've come to help you. Since midnight, you can see the handwriting on the wall. No more of those special rights you've always enjoyed. Or at least, you're going to have to share them. First with the Third World workers, and later with anyone who decides to join their cause. The streets are full. They've already taken over. Who knows, in a few minutes, whole families may show up at your door, and like it or not, you'll have to make room. They'll pitch camp in your parlor. Of course, we don't begrudge our poor desperate brothers, the ones who break their backs working for you folks, the ones you couldn't live without. But the rest of us, students, princes, professors, diplomats, intellectuals, artists, trainees in this or that, or nothing, take your pick. The rest of us are men of taste, steeped in your culture, your style, your way of life. Naturally, we want to preserve that elegance and refinement that we feel we owe so much. Clever argument, that. It usually got them. Now, the best thing would be if we moved in here with you. Two or three of us, that's all. Better to share with us, thinking alike the way we do, than to be invaded by a bunch of poor, ignorant beggars who don't mean any harm, heaven knows, but who just won't respect things, if you see what we mean. Madame, monsieur, it's getting late. When the others come to ring your bell, you'll really be much better off if they see a black face or two at the door. Come, let us take care of it. You go hide and leave everything to us. They spoke so well and looked so neat, spotless shirt, plain dark tie, horn-rimmed glasses, that the bourgeois couple, backs to the wall, could only agree. The least of two evils. These look all right, after all, and they're clean, and they spell nice. Better a no-good, fancy-dan snob than a plain, dirty nigger, no matter how honest. The gentleman, at least, won't touch my daughter. And so, with a simper, let us show you around. We could fix you a place. Maybe there, on the sofa. A bed, you say? Of course, that's the least we can do. We have two bathrooms. It won't be any trouble. Besides, it probably won't be for long. Then came the death blow. Why, yes, madame, for good. Quite so, for good. The rats won't give up that cheese called the West until they've devoured it to the very last crumb. Big and thick as it is, that will take them some time. They're at it, even now. But the cleverest of the rats saved the best part for themselves. Inevitable offshoot of any revolution. Yes, privileges there are, born of that historic night, and hailed at the same time as avant-garde triumphs, but everyone ignores them or pretends not to notice. And anyway, on basic issues, the new regime stands absolutely firm. Someone, for instance, came up recently with a plan for discreet exchanges in the living arrangements. Half an apartment occupied by blacks for half of another occupied by whites. No difference in the democratic use of the quarters, but only in their racial makeup. Certain whites who had managed to put aside some cash have been known to slip rather handsome bribes, sub rosa, of course, to their dark-skinned colleagues. It seems, in fact, that many such exchanges have been worked out in the recent past to everyone's satisfaction. But a stringent new law, intended to ensure a proper racial mix, has just put an end to such relics of a long past age. Perfectly logical. No point in abolishing the concept of race on a public level, just to turn right around and restore it in private. That wouldn't make sense now, would it? As we write these lines, we can't help but recall an old American law, dating back to 1970, forerunner of all anti-racist legislation, the school busing law, it was called. In those days, in the United States, the black and white races lived more or less apart, secluded from each other. That being the case, it was decided in the name of integration to transport a certain number of little white children to black schools and vice versa, in equal proportion. How many tots traveled scores and scores of miles each day while others went the same route exactly in reverse? Well, people protested. In the name of useless fatigue and absurd expense, freedom of choice, in the name of everything you please. But racism? Never. It was too late for that. Why, the very word was distasteful. So busing won out, and now they celebrate busing day in every school the whole world over. In conclusion, a few words about the inevitable appearance, that night, of the idiots, simpletons, madmen, and maniacs. When everything in society suddenly stops functioning rationally, that's when the misfits crawl up out of the woodwork, and with them their resentments, their utopian visions, their neuroses and psychoses, mad dogs on the loose, a merry-go-round of feeble minds, free at last of all social fetters. Historians faced with a mass of documents concerning that night, some of which reveal quite incredible details, came to the conclusion that society of that bygone era must have been oppressive to the utmost for its breakdown to unleash such a rash of psychic aberrations. Psychiatrists, by the way, exulted. They had long seen society as a fostering mental decay and had gone so far as to turn the insane back out on the streets so as not to compound one oppression with another. None of which, however, takes into account the vital role of the redemptive myth, self-inflicted and sublimated, like drugs in the past. But let's go on. This isn't the time for academic debates. Let's settle a few simple facts, among thousands. Sex crimes, small and large, were rampant on that night of nights, from indecent exposure to all the rest. Never had so many organs dangled from so many unzipped flies. While the normal people ran off or stayed in hiding, the public urinals, in Paris especially, and in all the big cities, had a sudden surge of traffic, the likes of which they hadn't seen since the liberation in 1944. It's no accident, clearly, that two myths of similar nature should produce the same results. From satyrs to sadist was just one easy step. And so the same young lady who felt she was being ogled and followed every day, common enough symptom of the modern urban illness, was killed this time by some hideous sex-crazed slayer. Even today, years later, they still dig up bodies of women and children from old abandoned building sites, like those bombs from past wars that surface in our cities every now and then. The same outburst spawned a flurry of accusations and denunciations. So many, in fact, that the authorities to this day haven't managed to sift through them all. And when the post office finally came back to something resembling normal, they were amazed at the number of anonymous letters slipped into the boxes that night. Of course, that wasn't really so unusual. In times of exceptional stress, humanity plumbs its most gangrenous depths. One novel element this time, though, the loads and loads of letters from children informing on mommy and daddy, if you please. Yet even there, no need for tears. In China, after all, during the Cultural Revolution, the youngsters had done much the same, with great abandon, and heaven only knows how the West heaped praises on them for it. As for old customs revived, let's mention just one, shaving the ladies' heads in revenge. Did such and such a secretary sleep with her boss, or this factory girl with her foreman? Next morning they found themselves bald as a Buddhist monk, not to mention the other forms of Gallic vendetta. Detestable, one and all. Tires slashed, house fronts splattered, windows broken, dogs poisoned, pastures plowed up, trees sawed in two. Of course, none of it tells us anything new about the consummate baseness of the folks of the time. At least their third-world confrères showed more dignity and style in settling their scores. And lastly, under the simpleton heading, the droll case of 300 villagers living outside the Air France flight school at Deauville-Saint-Gatien, invading the airport at 3 in the morning. To protest in the name of their own jangled nerves? Not a bit. Led by the mayor and official regalia, the bumpkin band, with pitchforks poised and flanked by their tousled females, black claws set to pounce, went storming the control tower in the name of the peace and tranquility of their cattle. Indeed, revolutions have been fought over less. Who knows where man's noble ideals may be lurking. The fact was that, with so many jets thundering overhead, the cows had quite simply begun to waste away. Now, in Normandy, if anything is sacred, it's the cow. The poor peasants had demonstrated time and time again, all to no avail, and their tempers were turning as sour as their animals' milk. And so, no sooner had the President of the Republic let down his guard on the mayor's TV screen than His Honor stood up, tossed off a shot of Calvados, and announced, "This time, men, I think we've got them." Traditionalist that he was, he had the tocsin rung, and no one in the village doubted what it meant. The Ganges fleet was none of their business. "We don't worry about politics here. We don't meddle in other folks' affairs. Just sweep up in front of our own door." But the airport now, that's something else. Ah, what a delightful concept. A momentous historic night, and that single tocsin pealing loud and clear to save a bunch of stupid cows. Chapter 41. The stars had dimmed. The moon had set. At the foot of a tall pine sat Colonel Dragases, warming his hands around a mug of steaming coffee. The searchlight on the roof of the villa was cutting its swath less sharply through the night. Not that the darkness had thickened around it, but rather because, as the outlines paled, they began to blend in with the moving white beam, pacing the beach like a sentry, glimpsed through the haze of the early morning mists. 5 o'clock. Everything was quiet on board the ships of the refugee fleet. Nothing was stirring. Only an occasional, barely noticeable tremor, rippling the surface of the bodies that lined the decks. Heads most likely, rearing ever so slightly, as daybreak neared, to gaze toward shore for an inkling of impending destiny. In Panama Rangers' camp, the noise had died down. Or rather, it had changed, gaining in refinement what it gave up in volume. No sounds but guitars now, strumming to the dismal wail of those soulful ballads so very much in vogue. It was a time, indeed, when the popular song wallowed in melancholy with its four-note laments intoned for oneself, one's fellows, all of mankind, and the rest. Whenever the pop tunes would lose their blaring charm, there was nothing left but to let oneself drown in the sticky sweet syrup of human misery and despair. Set to music of sorts, that one refuge of yearning and unfulfilled souls that had learned nothing else. It never occurred to any of them to measure that notion of misery against the past, or against their own well-being. For them it was a drug, and they needed to shoot up a good strong dose to keep themselves going, like addicts in their heroin. The fact that it was often hard to come by close to home made very little difference. Nothing stops an addict when he has to have his fix, and poisons like that are easy to import. There's never a lack of pushers. Besides, modern man has always had, tucked away in the back of his mind, that singular longing for total destruction, sole cure for the boredom and anguish that consume him. It's that hope that the beast had unleashed, exalting it in song. At that moment, in fact, a voice rose up over the rest, a young man's voice, pure and strong. And the others stopped to listen, then took up again in a chorus of responses, as they might have done at Vespers or the like, back in the days when such things were still sung. We should mention in passing that the slaughter of the ancient light liturgy, like the murder of everything else that was sacred, was no random operation. The reader shouldn't think for one moment that when they choked it all dead with their own two hands, the priest didn't know it would spring up again in some other guise. They knew perfectly well, and lots of them had reveled in giving the enemy the best of their weapons. The sacred had no more need now for God. The liturgy glorified mankind on earth. And the priests themselves, freed of their burden of divinity at last, could be like all the rest, and resume their status as everyday men. What the voice was singing was plainly obscene, but only the lyrics, and the young man's inspired tone made up for them nicely as he improvised his chant. For the Arab kicked in the balls, lying bleeding on the sidewalk, we'll tear this world down, we'll tear this sick world down, the chorus echoed. For the working girl knocked up some Saturday night, with a stupid damn baby in her belly, we'll tear this sick world down, we'll tear this sick world down. For the kid bawling his head off, who gets slugged by his old man, dead tired from his noisy machines, we'll tear this sick world down. For the poor starving black who sweeps up the crap of the rich people's dogs, we'll tear this sick world down. We'll tear this sick world down, the chorus repeated. But as things began to grow more tense, some few made up a few select additions. This goddamn stinking fucked up world. And over the twang of strumming guitars, each voice drew out the refrain with its own words of hate. Someone at a loss for adjectives, probably, even tossed the phrase the human world into the chorus, and never knew how hard God tried to forgive him. For the little old guy burping his gulp of wine at the charity Christmas party, we'll tear the sick world down. For the check of the big-hearted boss sends the priest at the charity Christmas party, we'll tear the sick world down. For the black girl's naked flesh sold on millionaire safaris, for the 25 wild boars the president bagged himself, for the millions of bodies shot full of holes by the gunrunner's greed, for the caviar wolf down in India one night when everyone else was starving, for the Indian dead of hunger at dawn on New Year's Day, for the Western murderers and the throats they slit when people wouldn't bow down and believe their shit. The colonel finished his coffee and observed as he lit a cigarette, now that one's more like it, much more poetic, even starting to rhyme. And that Western murderers bit isn't afar from the truth, by God, so sure of itself, that fine West of ours, so sure it could slap its blind culture on the world. so sure of the law that might makes right. Ah, the great things we did in the name of that law, and how nice it felt for all those years, making everyone accept it. He turned to the officer and asked, Captain, how many murderers by last count, please? As a 515 colonel, we had 220. Officers, non-coms, and enlisted men, not counting Monsieur Perret and his chauffeur. Wait, I take that back. He looked over and saw a figure fleeing through the darkness. Scratch the chauffeur. He just took off. That means 221 in all. Grand total, which is 200 down from 10 minutes ago, by the way. With cards like that, we'll be out of the game in no time. So saying, he stuck out his chin, froze his face in a rulebook stare, clicked his heels, and saluted. What's with you? Asked the colonel. Model soldier, the captain replied. Then he started rattling off, all in a single breath, in his most ceremonial of tones. French officer extraordinaire, with incredible vigor and no thought for his safety, led his man past all known bounds of courage and effected a first-rate retreat to the shores of the Mediterranean, submachine gun in hand, decorated for services above and beyond the call of duty. You wouldn't be pulling my leg, would you, Captain? You guessed it, Colonel. And they both burst out laughing. Then the captain went on. Frankly, I've never had so much fun. The ones who deserted had no sense of humor. That's their trouble. Like lots of people nowadays, a good sense of humor is pretty hard to find. So you're left with the cream, Colonel, the ones who think everything's a big goddamn joke, especially all this bleeding heart business. Eh, I'm afraid we're a little old-fashioned, John Perret broke in. Humor is out of style. Happiness is a crime. And ambition is just a dirty word. Everything that used to make life worth living, once upon a time, why, when I was their age... No comparisons, monsieur, the colonel interrupted. That's out, too. Besides, what's the use? Listen to these kids and their damnable prayers. Why, they're already old men and women at 20. What kind of an inspiration is that for today's young people? All taking their cue from the poorest, filthiest, stupidest, laziest, scruffiest scum on the lot. And whatever you do, don't ever look up or have any ideals. Never think for yourself. It's so much less sweat. Well, that's a hell of a way to try to build a world, even one like theirs. Never let yourself climb up on anyone's shoulders and try to rise above the crowd. Just follow along in the gutter, down with everyone else. Goodness, Colonel, the captain remarked. You're getting awfully serious. You're right. It won't happen again. Night was beginning to fade, and with it the sounds and voices so clear in the darkness. As Panama Ranger's litany grew dimmer, Colonel Drogases took a megaphone and put it to his lips. And he stood there, feet spread, huge colossus of a man, fairly bursting with health. Facing north toward his attackers and shouting, Screw you all, goddammit! Then he turned toward those around him and added, Not very clever original, but that's just the way I feel. Besides, they're not really the ones it's meant for, I don't suppose. Who then? Asked John Perret. The future, probably. From the occupied houses on all sides, the answer was quick and coming. Pig! Prick! Asshole! Filthy bastard! See? Said the colonel. They can't even say shit with style anymore. Cocksucker, motherfucker, murderer, fascist. Fascist, he echoed. And imperialist, capitalist, racist, militarist. When it comes to ist, I'll even insult myself. Hey, you guys on the roof, thank those kids over there for me, will you? The machine gun on top of the villa spat out a few rounds. Day had begun to break, and the men could now see what they were shooting at. Then a volley of angry shouts and the moans and groans of the wounded. Suddenly the squad leader threw down his binoculars. Good God, men, hold your fire. What's the matter, the colonel snapped. Don't tell me you're losing your sense of humor, too. No, colonel, it's just that we damn near shot down a pack of padres. So why should that bother you? And anyway, how can you tell? That's just it, colonel. These are even dressed like padres, like the kind I haven't seen in years and years. They're coming down the path. 32 degrees east, 1,800 meters, and they're singing. The one in front has on a kind of pointy white hat, and he's walking under a parasol or something with this funny-looking gold thing in his hands. No, 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 that's a mitre and a canopy, and the monstrance for the Blessed Sacrament, you dummy. And that's how we'll end it today, ending chapter 41 and page 239, session 9 of 11. We got two more to go. They'll be a little longer, about 35 to 40 pages apiece. We go from 240 up to the end on 311. They still haven't landed. Everything leading up to the landing. Are they going to land at all, or is it all about purely the attitudes? Well, we'll see. Anyway, thank you for being with me. I am Alex Linder. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, at alexlinder.com. Follow me on Twitter if you like. If I'm banned, I'll strike up anew. I like Twitter. And I'll be back with you again real soon.